Recording in progress.
As some people here know, last Sunday I introduced a koan, one of the Zen stories, that took the first line from a very famous Chinese poem called the Xin Xing Ming. And that's what I'm going to be talking about for the next weeks on Wednesdays, this long poem. And I'll give you a copy of the poem in just a few minutes. But I have learned after many years of teaching, don't give out students something to look at until it's time. Otherwise, that's all they do, right? Yeah. Pay attention. So I was thinking about how should I introduce this? This teaching poem that's left to us by Sengsan Jianshir, one of our Chinese ancestors, and I'll talk a little bit more about him in a moment. But I decided it would be good to begin with a story. The Zen tradition is full of wonderful, short, quirky stories. And stories have long really kind of nested in the very heart of the Zen tradition. And in these stories, we see the incredible creativity of our ancestors over the centuries in China, Japan, Korea particularly. And these stories were created to provoke in us questions. They were created to provoke us into arousing our curiosity and critical inquiry into the human condition, into our own life. And I think it is important to note that even within the Zen tradition itself, these stories were never evaluated on kind of like journalistic accuracy. In other words, did that really happen? No. But rather, the kind of mythopoetic creations of our Chinese and Japanese ancestors arising from very powerful religious imaginations over the centuries were skillfully designed to highlight the truths of this human life. So, one example of these stories is how the early lineage of Zen became established in China. So here's part of the story, just part, because the full story is really a kind of Sherazade-like, stories within stories within stories, right? And we'd have to spend here night after night after night like Sherazade did. So here's the beginning, a few stories. A monk named Bodhidharma arrived from Central Asia in the 6th century. He was the third son of a renowned Indian king, but decided not to inherit his father's kingdom, but became a monk. Described in the Chinese texts as ill-tempered, heavily bearded, with a big nose and a ring in his ear, he's revered as the blue-eyed barbarian. And soon after his arrival, he met the emperor at the time, Emperor Wu of Liang, and basically told the emperor to his face that all the good works that the emperor had done had no merit. And then Bodhidharma retired to a cave where he faced the wall for 9 years, not speaking for the entire time, until a Chinese monk named Hui Ke came to beg for teachings. Refused by Bodhidharma time and time again, Hui Ke, who had kept vigil for weeks in deep snow outside the monastery gates, finally cut off one arm to demonstrate his sincerity to Bodhidharma. You see what I mean by journalistic accuracy? I think you're getting the hint. So Bodhidharma, of course, finally accepted him as a student, and in the Zen tradition, Bodhidharma and Hui Ke are known as the first and second patriarchs of the tradition, respectively. Which brings us to Sensong, who would become the third Chinese Zen patriarch. Now, about him, it is said he had a disfiguring illness, probably leprosy or something very similar to leprosy. At any rate, it was especially a visible illness, disease that he had. And in China at that time, when a person had this kind of illness, a very visible kind of illness, it was considered to be a result of some evil or wrongdoing that the individual had done in the present life or in a past life. At any rate, at the age of 40, Sengsan finally met Huike, the second patriarch. And here's the story of their meeting. Sensong said, "I am riddled with sickness. Please absolve me of my fault." Huike replied, "Bring your fault here, and I will absolve you." Sensong, after a long pause, "When I look for my fault, I cannot find it." Huike, "I have absolved you. You should live by the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha." And with that, Sengsong became a student and became ordained. Now, after this exchange, Sengsong became the student of Huike and studied for at least 6 years. At least that's the kind of record that we have. And really, beyond this, there's very little known of him. Perhaps because it was a time when the Buddhist tradition was heavily persecuted in China. This was towards the end of the Tang Dynasty. At the beginning of that dynasty, Buddhism had been well supported by the emperor, by the central government, by various wealthy merchants, etc. But this was a time when it was persecuted, and Confucianism was coming forward as the main and most important teachings. So, although careful record keeping throughout most of Chinese history was the case, what we know about the Buddhist tradition during the years of 600 AD is really quite sparse. We don't have a lot of information. And particularly about the Zen tradition, and part of the reason for that, at this time there was no institutions. It was like individuals practicing and expanding and learning and creating what would become the Zen or the Chan, to use the Chinese expression, traditions and institutions. Anyway, there are a few more patriarchs and a few more interesting stories, but we'll leave them for another time. I want to return to Sensong and the Xinxing Ming, the poem that we're going to be looking at. So, Sengsong is claimed as the author of the Xinxing Ming, but many scholars doubt that that's really the case. But we can leave the argument to those who are interested in such matters. What is important for us is to note that this poem has been chanted and discussed in temples and places of practice from the beginning of the Zen tradition up until today. It has been quoted by many, many of our ancestors, both in China and Japan, the great teachers. And for example, the founder of Japanese Soto tradition, this tradition that we practice, he quotes a number of passages from this poem throughout his writings. And I'll talk about that a little bit maybe next week. And as we saw last Sunday when I gave my talk on the koan, that comes from the Blue Cliff record, we see it was quoted there, some of the lines from this poem. Now, why? Why is this such an important poem? Well, one reason for its popularity is that it's largely free of the kind of technical Indian vocabulary that was first brought into China. By this time, the Buddhist tradition had been well digested, and we're beginning to see Chinese forms of it, Chinese expressions of it. And so we see a particular Chinese approach to practice, a particular adopting of Chinese language as they're talking about the Buddhist traditions and practices and views. And these were much more harmonious to East Asia, basically Japan, Korea, and China. So although the Buddhist tradition had been in China for almost 600 years by the time this poem was written, when this poem appeared, it was kind of a fresh way to express the Dharma, a way that resonated deeply with Chinese language and culture. And, of course, this is important, right? The Buddhist tradition must undergo this when it enters a new era, when it enters a new country, in order for it to be really accessible. Constantly changing, because as we all know, nothing stays the same. Everything is impermanent. Everything needs to change. So because this is such an important teaching poem in the Zen tradition, it's been translated into English. I did a Google search on this, probed around. It's been translated, the Xin Chi Ming has been translated at least 30 times. I found 30 different versions of the Xin Chi Ming. And one of the most recent translations is by Kaz Tanahashi and Joan Halifax Roshi, names that you may be familiar with, contemporary teachers. Okay, well, that's enough background. Let's look at the title, Xin Chi Ming, composed of three Chinese characters. Xin Chi, the two first two words have different characters, even though the pronunciation is the same, so just bear with me for a moment. The first character, Xin, means faith or trust. In Chinese, the same character can represent both qualities, even though in English we kind of have quite a strong different nuance, right? And in a number of early Buddhist texts, faith or trust is considered one of the five qualities necessary for making any kind of progress on the Buddhist path. For example, a practitioner should have faith or trust in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, the three jewels, written many, many times in the early literature. Now, the Sanskrit word for faith or trust is shraddha. And the meaning, I think, is a little closer to trust. A trust that is based on personal experience. In the Buddha, for example, there's a famous dialogue that he had with a tribe when he was wandering in India known as the Kalamas. And I won't go into the whole story, but here's the kind of nut of it. This is the Buddha speaking. Come, Kalamas, do not go upon what has been acquired by repeated hearing, nor upon tradition, nor upon rumor, nor upon what is in a scripture, nor upon surmise, nor upon an axiom, nor upon specious reasoning, nor upon a bias toward a notion that has been pondered over, nor upon another's seeming ability, nor upon the consideration, the monk is our teacher. Kalamas, when you yourselves know these things are good, these things are not blamable. Undertake and observe these things will lead to benefit and happiness. Then enter on and abide in those things. Right? Very kind of typical early language. But the message is really clear, right? Don't believe the teacher. Don't believe because it's written down somewhere. You know, you have to believe your experience. So it's based on trust. Trust. Because you have at least tasted something. Oh, yeah. And sometimes when I've talked to my students at the university about this, I say, you know, why do you go to the doctor? Right? You have a pain, why don't you come to me? I'm your teacher. And they go, oh, no. Wouldn't come to you. because they have trust in the doctor. They have been to a doctor before. They have seen the diploma on the wall, maybe. The doctor has helped them before. Of course, that's how we begin. And that's how practice begins. Maybe you've read something about meditation practice. You try it. Oh, there is a little ease here, a little benefit. I come again. I come again. And thus it builds. So the second character, Shin, is the character for mind or heart. Again, in Chinese, the same character can represent both. Sometimes in English we say heart-mind to include that. But in this particular case, this word Shin, heart-mind, has a special meaning in the Zen tradition. In this case, it represents the fundamental, unmoving, unchanging quality of all sentient beings. Sometimes referred to as the unchanging mind. In other words, it's a particular Chinese expression to represent something like the Buddha nature, the awakened mind, the absolute, the quality of interbeing, one's true nature, nirvana, all those many words that we see written in various Buddhist texts and elsewhere, all pointing to the ineffable, to what we cannot really put words to, but we are drawn to that. And then, so that Shin Shin, right? Trust, mind, the last word, Ming, means something like inscription or message. So putting this all together, we may translate the title as Inscription on Trusting in Mind. But there are many, many other possibilities. Chinese is wonderful this way, and frustrating. One scholar I read made a very good argument for the title being Inscription on Relying on the Mind, relying on this, we call it big mind, relying on something that goes beyond our everyday mind. And others have proposed Inscription on the Perfected Mind, the Mind of Absolute Trust, on Believing in Mind, and many, many, many others. As I said, there's at least 30 translations that I discovered. So this poem is made of 36 verses, each composed of two lines of four characters. And these, in classical or ancient Chinese, these are rhymed. So it's easy to remember if you spoke Chinese. So now, at last, I'll pass out this, and our Zoom Eno will bring up at least the first page on the screen for people who are on Zoom. This poem, now you can also find this on our website. So you can print it out for yourself. And I'd recommend it because we will be doing this for the next few weeks. Thank you. Everyone got one? So let's just read the first, what at least is broken up here into a stanza, even though in Chinese it's not. But let's just read that. So the great way is not difficult for those not attached to preferences. When neither love nor hate arises, all is clear and undisguised. Separate by the smallest amount, however, and you are as far from it as heaven is from earth. That's as far as we'll get tonight. The great way is not difficult for those not attached to preferences. In China, at roughly the same time of the Buddha, there arose the concept of Dao, D-A-O. And in Chinese, the word Dao means the way or the path. And in this poem, we see the use of the Taoist words and views combined with the views coming in from India, the Buddhist views coming in from India. So I just need to say a word about Tao, or this word about the great way. Tao is understood in ancient Chinese culture as emphasizing the inconceivable harmonious workings of nature. It represents the flowing function and deep connection of all things. Tao. And there's much more to we could say about it. It's a very sophisticated and a very important view of the world. But I'd like to emphasize, it represents the flowing function and deep connection of all things. The constant impermanence of changing of all things, but also the interconnection of all things. So in the word Tao came to be used to translate the Sanskrit word Bodhi, which means awakening, and Marga, which means the path. Tao is used for both of these. So awakening and the path. So the great way, referring to maybe what we may call the ineffable, or referring to the great mind, the way of expressing, the way of fully expressing your life, perhaps. So in the opening line, we get the indication this poem is kind of an instruction, a guide for how to approach this great way, how to fully express and live your life. In the talk I gave last Sunday, the word that we see here is preferences. The translator who had translated that particular koan, you translated that as picking and choosing. Preferences, picking and choosing. And not attached to, that translator had said, if you don't. So if you don't pick and choose. The great way is not difficult if you don't pick and choose. But I like this translation. The great way is not difficult for those not attached to preferences. Not attached to preferences makes clear that the real issue is not preferences themselves. After all, we make hundreds of choices in our daily life, largely based on our preferences, right? The problem is when we become attached, when we grasp onto those preferences. In other words, when we find ourselves defending those preferential choices and blind to a larger inclusive view. Sensong is telling us here that our reactive habitual grasping, which manifests in our choices quite often, in our preferences, this obscures the great way. This breaks the harmony and our connection with all things. But please be aware, please note, in this poem, preferences doesn't mean the kind of ice cream you like, right? It's not a contest between J.R. Garcia and chocolate marble chip something. It's not referring to the movies we like and don't like, but it's referring to the deep story of how we imagine our life should be and our constant lamenting and struggling to make our actual life accord to that story. Sensong tells us not to be attached, not to attach. In other words, let go. And when we let go of trying to fit our life into our actual life, into the story of our life, then we are open to the great way, because we meet our life as it is. We can respond to what arises because we're not trying to manipulate it, to run away from whatever life is giving us at this moment, or to hang on to it. So this letting go, or this meeting our life as it is, free of our preferences, free of our judgments, is really at the heart of our practice. Ajahn Chah, the great Thai forest monk, expressed this practice of letting go really beautifully. I just want to read a short passage. He's talking to one of his students. It may have been Jack Kornfield, I can't remember now. Try to be mindful and let things take their natural course. Then your mind will become still in any surroundings, like a clear forest pool. All kinds of wonderful rare animals will come to drink at the pool, and you will clearly see the nature of all things. You will see many strange and wonderful things come and go, but you will be still. This is the happiness of the Buddha. Can we let go of our preference to be right? Can we let go of our preference to be accepted and seen by others in a certain way? Can we let go of having to have our life go according to our plan? Or can we let go of trying to always abide in clarity, as our old friend Zhaozhou brought up for us last Sunday in the talk? Let go, let go. How do you let go? Well, we'll talk more about that a bit later. Let's look at the next little verse goes, when neither love nor hate arises, all is clear and undisguised. Now the translator here chose the words love and hate, and I looked at the Chinese, and indeed it does say love. But I think these English words are perhaps too strong to really capture the Buddhist sensibility of the poem. Some translators have used like and dislike. So when neither like nor dislike arises, all is clear and undisguised. And I think that perhaps more accurately reflects the intent of the poem, and certainly seems much more in line with the Buddhist teachings. To be caught in like and dislike is to be pushed and pulled by the eight worldly winds. The eight worldly winds of praise and blame, success and failure, pleasure and pain, fame and disrepute. Right? I bet you have a preference for pleasure rather than pain. Or praise rather than blame. In our Zazen practice, we become more aware of these winds that blow in our life. And with that awareness, our conditioned reactivity to them lessens. Right. I try anything to avoid blame. I try anything to get praise. Anything to avoid failure. I'll do anything to reach success. Good luck. Because we react, right? And when our reactivity is absent, then we see things clearly. Because we're no longer struggling with one of those eight worldly winds. We just see it all. This moment, this is happening. Rather than through the distorting lens of scrabbling to get something or scrabbling to push it away. Ah, yes, here. And maybe you've experienced some moments like this in your practice and in your life. Just to see this moment of your life with clarity is to be in a great way. The last couplet here. Separate by the smallest amount, however, and you are as far from it as heaven is from earth. When we engage with our likes and dislikes, a separation occurs immediately, right? Because an expectation arises of how things should be, how we want them to be, how they need to be, rather than how they are. Reactive preferences cause a lack of harmony, a lack of balance, because they limit our view. They limit the possibilities of how we may meet this moment of our life. A child hopelessly crying because he dropped his ice cream cone. He's not aware of the greater view. The view that, well, sometimes ice cream cones drop. And more ice cream cones will probably come in the future. And in the scheme of life's tragedies, this is a pretty small one. Our practice, both on and off the meditation cushion, brings us back into harmony and balance by creating the capacity to meet and to hold tenderly the minor and the major tragedies of this life. Someday, if you haven't already experienced it, you will experience a major tragedy. That's just part of the human condition. How will you meet it? This poem is, as we'll see in the coming weeks, is encouraging us to meet it fully, with a wide open view and a wide open heart. Both the great beauty of this life and the painful tragedies of this life. And it will give us, over the coming weeks, I think, some skillful means, as we say in the Buddhist tradition, to help us with this. But I'm going to stop talking here, because I would like you guys to have a few moments to talk. And I'd like you to tell stories. Let me give you an example. Maybe you could tell about how one or more of the worldly winds of praise and blame, success and failure, pleasure and pain, fame and disrepute. You don't have to do all of them. But one of those worldly winds, how has that buffeted you throughout your life or today? Think of an example, maybe. Tell a story. Maybe a story that's a good story. Doesn't have to be a tragedy. And if that doesn't ring a bell at the moment, maybe you could talk about ways you may let go of your habitual grasping of things. What may just see what you can come up with. Is there a story around that? An example of what you habitually grasp at and how you may like to let go of that? And if that doesn't ring a bell, you can talk about anything that I've talked about. That'd be fine too. So this is how we'll do it. I'll just pause there.